Hi folks, this is Rue.
And Dave.
Welcome to So Many Books.
So Little Time.
We're going to continue today with the next chapters of Ella Montgomery's Anne of Green Gables.
Cue the music. Ooh, how are you doing, Rue?
Can we start with our obligatory weather statement of it's hot and we don't like it? I think that summarizes the weather right now.
No, sir. I don't like it.
No. We've had a week. The smoke from the last episode, we mentioned the smoke from the bushfires. It's been hellish. And it's not summer yet.
Yeah, it's only the middle of November.
Yeah, I'm going to point out that this is our spring, and we are already getting fairly hammered. I mean, it's not as hot as summer. That's a whole nother experience.
Well, you know, December is usually a wet month, but then November is usually a wet month, and it hasn't been.
No, our storm season is a little out of whack. But yes.
So, I mean, usually the Christmas season is appropriate for roasting chestnuts, but they'll be roasting just from the temperature.
Usually you can fry an egg on the road at this, in this kind of temperature.
Oh, yeah. You know how I knew it was hot? I went out to, it was last week, actually. I went out to hang my washing on a line. I'm like, oh, the concrete is very hot. I need sandals.
Yes, that's the difference between... This is how we determine the difference between winter and spring and summer.
And my roommate's one worse because he hangs his washing on a contraption he has on the balcony attached to his bedroom, and that's wood. And wood in heat is so much worse than concrete in heat. He burnt the soles of his feet, pretty much.
It can be unpleasant. So basically, it's hot and we don't like it. That is how I'm summarizing the current weather situation.
Meanwhile, over in Green Gables, Anne lost a friend and she doesn't like it.
Well, Anne hasn't lost a friend. Anne has been, had the friendship, the friendship with Anne has been intervened with due to the mother.
Interrupted.
Yes, has an interrupted friendship. And we will find out what happens.
If only Diana wasn't so greedy.
A bit more complicated, but yes. And A New Interest in Life is this chapter, which is a nice title.
Let's see what it is.
Yes. The next afternoon, Anne, bending over her patchwork at the kitchen window, happened to glance out and beheld Diana down by the dryad's bubble, beckoning mysteriously. In a trice, Anne was out of the house and flying down to the hollow, astonishment and hope struggling in her expressive eyes. But the hope faded when she saw Diana's dejected countenance. "Your mother hasn't relented," she gasped. Diana shook her head mournfully. "No. And, oh, Anne, she says I'm never to play with you again. I've cried and cried, and I told her it wasn't your fault, but it wasn't any use. I had ever such a time coaxing her to let me come down and say goodbye to you. She said I was only to stay 10 minutes, and she's timing me by the clock. 10 minutes isn't very long to say an eternal farewell in," said Anne tearfully. "Oh, Diana, will you promise faithfully never to forget me, the friend of your youth, no matter what dearer friends may caress thee?"
Jeez.
Far out. "Indeed I will," sobbed Diana. "And I'll never have another bosom friend. I don't want to have. I couldn't love anybody as I love you." "Oh, Diana," cried Anne, clasping her hands, "do you love me?" "Why, of course I do. Didn't you know that?"
There's an interesting point there. She wouldn't know.
Mm-hmm.
"No," Anne drew a long breath. "I thought you liked me, of course, but I never hoped you loved me. Why, Diana, I didn't think anybody could love me."
Oh.
There's the pain. There's the pain. Yep. "Nobody ever has loved me since I can remember. Oh, this is wonderful. It's a ray of light which will forever shine on the darkness of a path severed from thee, Diana." My God, the floral language. She's so funny. "Oh, just say it once again." "I love you devotedly, Anne," said Diana staunchly. "And I always will, you may be sure of that." "And I will always love thee, Diana," said Anne, solemnly extending her hand.
In the years to come, thy memory will shine like a star over my lonely life. As that last story we read together says, Diana, wilt thou give me a lock of thy jet-black tresses in parting to treasure forevermore?
She doesn't do anything by halves.
No, she doesn't. And I think also what she's reading is influencing her language big time. Have you got anything to cut it with? Queried Diana, wiping away the tears which Anne's affecting accents caused to flow afresh and returning to practicalities. Yes, I've got my patchwork scissors in my apron pocket, fortunately, said Anne. She solemnly clipped one of Diana's curls. Fare thee well, my beloved friend. Henceforth we must be as strangers, though living side by side. But my heart will ever be faithful to thee. Anne stood and watched Diana out of sight, mournfully waving her hand to the latter whenever she turned to look back. Then she returned to the house, not a little consoled for the time being by this romantic parting. It is all over, she informed Marilla. I shall never have another friend. I'm really worse off than ever before, for I haven't Katie Maurice and Violetta now, and even if I had it, wouldn't be the same. Somehow little dream girls are not satisfying after a real friend. Diana and I had such an affecting farewell down by the spring. It will be sacred in my memory forever. I used the most pathetic language I could think of, and said thou and thee. Thou and thee seem so much more romantic than you. Diana gave me a lock of her hair, and I'm going to sew it up in a little bag and wear it around my neck all my life. Please see to it that it is buried. Oh, God, she's so funny. Please see that it is buried with me, for I don't believe I'll live very long. I know. We shouldn't laugh. It's like the only time she's ever felt like being told that she's loved. She's like...
But
which is fair, which explains why she is reacting the way she does a lot of the time.
I guess it's just the melodrama is so funny.
It is, and I think that's part of it. It's why this book is so funny. For I don't believe I'll live very long. Perhaps when she sees me lying cold and dead before her, Mrs. Barry may feel remorse for what she has done and will let Diana come to my funeral. Next. We know Marilla's going to say something. I don't think there is much fear of your dying of grief, as long as you can talk, Anne, said Marilla unsympathetically. The following Monday, Anne surprised Marilla by coming down from her room with her basket of books on her arm and hip, and her lips primmed up in a line of determination. I'm going back to school, she announced. That is all there is left in life for me, now that my friend has been ruthlessly torn from me. In school, I can look at her and muse over days departed. You'd better muse over your lessons and sums, said Marilla, concealing her delight at this development of the situation. If you're going back to school, I'll hope we'll hear no more of breaking slates over people's heads and such carryings on. Behave yourself and just do what your teacher tells you. I'll try to be a model pupil, agreed Anne dolefully. There won't be much fun in it, I expect. Mr. Phillips said Minnie Andrews was a model pupil, and there isn't a spark of imagination or life in her. She's just dull and pokey, and never seems to have a good time. But I feel so depressed that perhaps it will come easy to me now. I'm going round by the road. I couldn't bear to go by the birch path all alone. I should weep bitter tears if I did. Anne was welcomed back to school with open arms. Her imagination had been sorely missed in games. Her voice in the singing, and her dramatic ability in the perusal aloud of books at dinner hour. Ruby Gillis smuggled 3 blue plums over to her during testament reading. Ella Mae McPherson gave her an enormous yellow pansy cut from the covers of a floral catalogue, a species of desk decoration much prized in Avonlea School. Sophia Sloane offered to teach her a perfectly elegant new pattern of knit lace, so nice for trimming aprons. Katie Bolter gave her a perfume bottle to keep slate water in, and Julia Bell copied carefully on a piece of pale pink paper scalloped on the edges the following effusion. When twilight drops her curtain down and pins it with a star, remember that you have a friend, though she may wander far. It's so nice to be appreciated, sighed Anne rapturously to Marilla that night. The girls were not the only scholars who appreciated her. When Anne went to her seat after dinner hour, she had been told by Mr. Phillips to sit with the model Minnie Andrews, she found on her desk a big, luscious strawberry apple. Anne caught it up, all ready to take a bite, when she remembered that the only place in Avonlea where strawberry apples grew was in the old Blythe orchard to the... Oh, no. Anne caught it up, all ready to take a bite, when she remembered that the only place in Avonlea where strawberry apples grew was in the old Blythe orchard on the other side of the Lake of Shining Waters. Anne dropped the apple, as if it were a red-hot coal, and ostentatiously wiped her fingers on her handkerchief. The apple lay untouched on her desk until the next morning when little Timothy Andrews, who swept the school and kindled the fire, annexed it as one of his perquisites. Charlie Sloat's slate pencil, gorgeously bedizened, with striped red and yellow paper, costing 2 cents when ordinary pencils cost only one, which he had sent up to her after dinner hour, met with a far more favorable reception. Anne was graciously pleased to accept it, and rewarded the donor with a smile which exalted the infatuated youth straightway into the seventh heaven of delight, and caused him to make such fearful errors in his dictation that Mr. Phillips kept him in after school to rewrite it. That was funny. But as the Caesar's pageant shorn of Brutus's bust did but of Rome's best son remind her more, so the marked absence of any tribute or recognition from Diana Barry, who was sitting with Gertie Pye, embittered Anne's little triumph. "Diana might have smiled at me once, I think," she mourned to Marilla that night. But the next morning, a note most fearfully and wonderfully twisted and folded, and a small parcel were passed across to Anne. "Dear Anne," ran the former, "Mother says I'm not to play with you or talk to you even in school. It isn't my fault, and don't be cross with me, because I love you as much as ever. I miss you awfully to tell all my secrets to, and I don't like Gertie Pye one bit. I made you one of the new bookmarkers out of red tissue paper. They are awfully fashionable now, and only 3 girls in school know how to make them. When you look at it, remember, your true friend, Diana Barry." Anne read the note, kissed the bookmark, and dispatched a prompt reply back to the other side of the school. "My own darling Diana, of course I'm not cross at you, because you have to obey your mother. Our spirits can commune. I shall keep your lovely present forever. Minnie Andrews is a very nice little girl, although she has no imagination. But after having been Diana's bosom friend," with bosom, misspelt.
Yeah.
"But after having been Diana's bosom friend, I cannot be Minnie's. Please excuse mistakes, because my spelling isn't very good yet, although much improved." Again, spelt wrong.
Oh my goodness, the spelling mistakes are in the book. That's great.
Yes, yes. "Yours until death do us part, Anne," or Cordelia, "Shirley." "P.S. I shall sleep with your letter under my pillow tonight. A or C.S. Marilla pessimistically expected more trouble, since Anne had again begun to go to school. But none developed. Perhaps Anne caught something of the model spirit from Minnie Andrews. At least she got on very well with Mr. Phillips thenceforth. She flung herself into her studies heart and soul, determined not to be outdone in any class by Gilbert Blythe. The rivalry between them was soon apparent. It was entirely good-natured on Gilbert's side, but it is much to be feared that the same thing cannot be said of Anne, who had certainly an unpraiseworthy tenacity for holding grudges. She was as intense in her hatreds as in her loves. She would not stoop to admit that she meant to rival Gilbert in schoolwork, because that would have been to acknowledge his existence, which Anne persistently ignored. But the rivalry was there, and honors fluctuated between them. Now Gilbert was head of the spelling class. Now Anne, with the toss of her long red braids, spelled him down. One morning, Gilbert had all his sums done correctly, and had his name written on the blackboard on the roll of honor. The next morning, Anne, having wrestled wildly with decimals the entire evening before, would be first. One awful day, they were ties, and their names were written up together. It was almost as bad as a take notice, and Anne's mortification was as evident as Gilbert's satisfaction. When the written examinations at the end of each month were held, the suspense was terrible. The first month, Gilbert came out 3 marks ahead. The second, Anne beat him by 5. But her triumph was marred by the fact that Gilbert congratulated her heartily before the whole school. It would have been ever so much sweeter to her if he had felt the sting of his defeat. Mr. Phillips might not be a very good teacher, but a pupil so inflexibly determined on learning as Anne was could hardly escape making progress under any kind of teacher. By the end of the term, Anne and Gilbert were both promoted into the fifth class and allowed to begin studying the elements of the branches by which Latin, geometry, French, and algebra were meant. In geometry, Anne met her Waterloo.
I never liked all that triangle stuff.
It took me until I was teaching it to actually grasp the relationship between circles and angles and cos, sine, and tan. That right. whole stuff was complicated until I saw it in an animated visual thing, and then it all clicked. So, her Waterloo. "It's perfectly awful stuff, Marilla," she groaned. "I'm sure I'll never be able to make head or tail of it. There is no scope for imagination in it at all. Mr. Phillips says I'm the worst dunce he ever saw at it, and some of the others are so smart at it. It is extremely mortifying, Marilla. Even Diana gets along better than I do. But I don't mind being beaten by Diana. Even though we meet as strangers now, I still love her with an inextinguishable love. It makes me very sad at times to think about her. But really, Marilla, one can't stay sad very long in such an interesting world, can one?"
Well, she still has a good outlook.
I think, as she says, she's still in pain. She's still hurting. But she's also, there's so much to learn, there's so much to do, and she's been thirsting for this.
So the new interest that the title of the chapter meant was her studies.
Her studies, and I think generally, she's being appreciated, she's realizing other people appreciate her. She still won't let them be that close, but she still is enjoying the fact that she is socially not being rejected, basically.
And maybe it's one of those things, because the bosom friend sounds like very much something she's built up in her head, you know, or maybe read in a story. And she had one, and then she lost it, so maybe she will never have another.
Well, I think she promised that to Diana. Both of them said, no, we're never going to have a friend like that. So that absolute closeness, she's not expecting to have that again. And I don't think she'll let it happen in the same way. She meets plenty of... Well, she was saying that, you know, Matthew is a kindred spirit. People are kindred spirits. So there's kindred spirits and then there's bosom friends. So it's interesting to see the world from her perspective.
And maybe it's a greed thing as well, where she thought, you know, the fact that she even got to have one is a miracle, so she doesn't really expect it to ever happen again.
Well, we had that the bit where she's like, love? I didn't even expect you to, I thought you might like me, but I didn't think you'd, and for her, that's a huge deal, and of course it is.
I bet in any on-screen adaptation, that scene is quite touching.
I'm sure it is. But now...
Another chapter.
This is chapter 18, and it is mysteriously titled, "Anne to the Rescue." Yep. "All things great are wound up with all things little. At first glance, it might not seem that the decision of a certain Canadian premier to include Prince Edward Island in a political tour could have much or anything to do with the fortunes of little Anne Shirley at Green Gables. But it had."
Oh, no.
"It was a January. The Premier came to address his loyal supporters and such of his non-supporters as chose to be present at the monster mass meeting held in Charlottetown. Most of the Avonlea people were on Premier's side of politics, hence on the night of the meeting, nearly all the men and a goodly proportion of the women had gone to town 30 miles away. Mrs. Rachel Lynde had gone too. Mrs. Rachel Lynde was a red-hot politician and couldn't have believed that the political rally could be carried through without her, although she was on the opposite side of politics. So she went to town and took her husband. Thomas would be useful in looking after the horse, and Marilla Cuthbert with her. Marilla had a sneaking interest in politics herself, and as she thought it might be her only chance to see a real-life premier, she promptly took to it, leaving Anne and Matthew to keep house until her return the following day. Hence, while Marilla and Mrs. Rachel were enjoying themselves hugely at the mass meeting,
Anne and Matthew had the cheerful kitchen at Green Gables all to themselves. A bright fire was glowing in the old-fashioned Waterloo stove, and blue-white frost crystals were shining on the window panes. Matthew nodded over a farmer's advocate on the sofa, and Anne at the table studied her lessons with grim determination, despite sundry wistful glances at the clock shelf, where lay a new book that Jane Andrews had lent her that day. Jane had assured her that it was warranted to produce any number of thrills, or words to that effect, and Anne's fingers tingled to reach out for it. But that would mean Gilbert Blythe's triumph on the morrow. Anne turned her back to the clock shelf and tried to imagine it wasn't there. Matthew, did you ever study geometry when you went to school? Well, no, I didn't, said Matthew, coming out of his doze with a start. I wish you had, sighed Anne, because then you'd be able to sympathize with me. You can't sympathize properly if you've never studied it. It is casting a cloud over my whole life. I'm such a dunce at it, Matthew. Well, now, I don't know, said Matthew soothingly. I guess you're all right at anything. Mr. Phillips told me last week at Blair's store at Carmody that you was the smartest scholar in school and was making rapid progress. Rapid progress was his very words. There's them as runs down Teddy Phillips, and I says he ain't much of a teacher, but I guess he's all right. Matthew would have thought anyone who praised Anne was all right. I'm sure I'd get better on with geometry if only he wouldn't change the letters, complained Anne. I learn the proposition by heart, and then he draws it out on the blackboard and puts different letters from water in the book, and I get all mixed up. I don't think a teacher should take such a mean advantage, do you? We're studying agriculture now, and I found out at last what makes the roads red. It's a great comfort. I wonder how Marilla and Mrs. Lynde are enjoying themselves. Mrs. Lynde says Canada is going to the dogs the way things are being run at Ottawa, and that it's an awful warning to the electors. She says if women were allowed to vote, we would soon see a blessed change. What way do you vote, Matthew? Conservative, said Matthew promptly. To vote conservative was part of Matthew's religion. Then I'm conservative too, said Anne decidedly. I'm glad because some of the boys at school are grits. I guess Mr. Phillips is a grit too, because Prissy Andrews' father is one, and Ruby Gillis says that when a man is courting, he always has to agree with the girl's mother in religion and her father in politics. Is that true, Matthew? Well, no, I don't know, said Matthew. Did you ever go courting, Matthew? Well, now, no, I don't know if I ever did, said Matthew, who certainly never thought of such a thing in his whole existence. Anne reflected with her chin in her hands. It must be rather interesting, don't you think, Matthew? Ruby Gillis says that when she grows up, she's going to have ever so many beaux on the string and have them all crazy about her. But I think that would be too exciting. I'd rather have just one in his right mind. Ruby Gillis knows a great deal about such matters because she has so many big sisters. And Mrs. Lynde says the Gillis girls have gone off like hotcakes. Mr. Phillips goes up to see Prissy Andrews nearly every evening. He says it's to help her with her lessons, but Miranda Sloane is studying for Queen's too, and I should think she needed help a lot more than Prissy because she's ever so much stupider. But he never goes to help her in the evenings at all. There are a great many things in the world that I can't understand very well, Matthew. Well, now, I don't know as I comprehend them all myself, acknowledged Matthew. Well, I suppose I must finish up my lessons. I won't allow myself to open that new book Jane lent me until I'm through. But it's a terrible temptation, Matthew. Even when I turn my back on it, I can see it there, just as plain. Jane said she cried herself sick over it. I love a book that makes me cry, but I think I'll carry that book into the sitting room and lock it in the jam closet and give you the key. And you must not give it to me, Matthew, until my lessons are done, not even if I implore you on my bended knees. It's all very well to say resist temptation, but it's ever so much easier to resist it if you can't get the key. And then, shall I run down the cellar and get some russets? Matthew, would you like some russets? Well, now, I don't know, but what I would, said Matthew, who never ate russets, but knew Anne's weakness for them.
What do you reckon russets are?
Apple.
Ah.
Yeah. Just as Anne emerged triumphantly from the cellar with her plateful of russets, came the sound of flying footsteps
on the icy boardwalk outside, and the next moment the kitchen door was flung open, and in rushed Diana Barry, white-faced and breathless, with a shawl wrapped hastily around her head. Anne promptly let go of her candle and plate in her surprise, and plate, candle, and apples crashed together down the cellar ladder, and were found at the bottom embedded in melted grease the next day by Marilla, who gathered them up and thanked mercy the house hadn't been set on fire. "Whatever is the matter, Diana?" cried Anne. "Has your mother relented at last?" "Oh, Anne, do come quick," implored Diana nervously. "Minnie May is awful sick. She's got croup." "Young Mary Jo says, and father and mother are away to town, and there's nobody to go for the doctor. Minnie May is awful bad, and young Mary Jo doesn't know what to do. And, oh, Anne, I'm so scared." Matthew, without a word, reached out for cap and coat, slipped past Diana and away into the darkness of the yard. "He's gone to harness the sorrel mare to go to Carmody for the doctor," said Anne, who was hurrying on hood and jacket. "I know it as well as if he'd said so. Matthew and I are such kindred spirits, I can read his thoughts without words at all." "I don't believe he'll find the doctor at Carmody," sobbed Diana. "I know that Dr. Blair went to town, and I guess Dr. Spencer would too. Young Mary Jo never saw anybody with croup, and Mrs. Lynde is away. Oh, Anne." "Don't cry, Di," said Anne cheerily. "I know exactly what to do for croup. You forget that Mrs. Hammond had twins 3 times. When you look after 3 pairs of twins, you naturally get a lot of experience. They all had croup regularly. Just wait till I get the ipecac bottle. You mayn't have any at your house. Come on now."
What's croup?
It's a form of respiratory illness. I'd have to look it up, but it's one you don't hopefully see as much as we used to.
Like tuberculosis is kind of gone.
Well, it does happen fairly regularly still. But it's usually an infection. Yeah, upper airway infection that blocks breathing and has distinctive barking cough.
And Anne's going to make her throw up.
Yep.
So that clear the...
Yeah, it's to get the phlegm out.
Right.
It's quite common. Like, it can get... Mild cases of it happen quite regularly, but when it's an intense case, it's quite dangerous.
Well, that kind of reminds me, you know, I only get sick maybe once a year, but yeah. 2 years ago, I had one where, like, there was this lump of phlegm in my throat that kept trying to come out, but it wouldn't. It was, like, attached to my throat and was just the most annoying and worrying thing because it always felt like it was blocking my airwaves, but I couldn't get rid of it either. I wonder if that was like a similar thing.
Well, what it is, I'm just going to jump to the thing. Croup is a condition caused by viral infection. It leads to the swelling of the voice box, larynx, and the windpipe, trachea. This swelling makes the airway narrower, so it's harder to breathe. Yeah. Children with croup develop a harsh, barking cough and may make a noisy, high-pitched sound when they breathe in, like that. Yeah, Strider. Croup mostly affects children between 6 and 5 years old, but it can affect older children. Some children get croup several times.
Right.
It can get worse quickly, and as soon as there's difficulties breathing, you need to seek medical advice. And we're talking now, 2019.
Is respiratory infection one of those things like once you get it once, you might be more susceptible to it again?
Depends on the infection.
Because I've heard that about ear infections.
In theory, if it's in any way immunosuppressive or it causes tissue damage or it's not a straightforward thing.
Okay.
But usually when you have, for example, a flu, you're more prone to get a bacterial infection.
Okay.
Because it also has an immune suppressive effect. Right. It's a bit messy. They say, okay, so the difference between mild and severe, just lost my word. So mild would be if you have the cough, if the child has the cough, but doesn't have the stridor, that, you know, difficulty inhaling, when they're calm and settled, not when they're distressed.
Yeah, yeah.
If they are, usually you don't need to treat that much other than, I mean, you'd use steam, you'd make sure that the environment is safe. Keep them calm. If they have a fever, give them paracetamol or ibuprofen, depending on what is appropriate. Things like that. And at night, it tends to get worse.
Well, Anne doesn't have paracetamol or ibuprofen.
Yep. Oh, okay. No steam. Apparently, they've ruled that out now. Sorry. Amend that. But yes, steam and humidifiers are no longer recommended because there's no evidence to suggest they're beneficial. But they do say, like, this is a serious thing. Like, if...
Well, yeah, anything that blocks your ability to breathe.
Yeah, breathing is always the key thing. So if your child is struggling to breathe, child looks very sick, becomes pale and drowsy, child's lips are blue in color, hopefully you never get to that point, or child starts to drool and can't swallow. There's a whole bunch of things that they've got for warnings, and they do generally think. I mean, let's not talk about what the modern treatment is because there's going to be other treatments now. But at the time,
Yeah. Anne's probably got the right idea.
Anne's going straight for Ipecac, which is a what do you call it? Something that causes
A
emesis.
purgent?
No, maybe. I don't know the word. Anyway, this is not going to too much with the thing. But so. The two little girls hastened out, hand in hand, and hurried through Lover's Lane and across the crusted field beyond, for the snow was too deep to go by the shorter woodway. Anne, although sincerely sorry for Minnie May, was far from being insensible to the romance of the situation and the sweetness of once more sharing that romance with a kindred spirit. Pausing here, because it's interesting how the term romance is used in this context. We have associated it with so much with, the idea of romance of
Courting.
courting or those kind of relationships between two individuals who have interest in them, each other in a different kind of relationship. But this is the romance of friendship, almost.
Or the romance of the
Yeah,
situation.
the situation, but also this idea of being. I think the term has changed. We must have changed the way we understood it, which is so maybe something for thought. The night was clear and frosty, all ebony of shadow and silver of snowy slope. Big stars were shining over the silent fields. Here and there, the dark pointed firs stood up with snow powdering their branches and the wind whistling through them. Anne thought it was truly delightful to go skimming through all this mystery and loveliness with your bosom friend, who had been so long estranged. Minnie May, aged 3, was really very
Oh,
sick.
damn, 3 years old,
Yeah.
yeah.
At least not younger than 6 months, but 3 is still very young. She lay on the kitchen sofa, feverish and restless, while her hoarse breathing could be heard all over the house. Young Mary Joe, a buxom, broad-faced French girl from the creek, whom Mrs. Barry had engaged to stay with the children during her absence, was helpless and bewildered, quite incapable of thinking what to do, or doing it if she thought of it. Anne went to work with skill and promptness. Minnie May has croup all right. She's pretty bad, but I've seen them worse. First, we must have lots of hot water. I declare, Diana, there isn't more than a cupful in the kettle. There, I filled it up, and Mary Joe, you may put some wood in the stove. I don't want to hurt your feelings, but it seems to me that you might have thought of this before if you'd had any imagination. Now, I'll undress Minnie May and put her to bed, and you'll find some soft flannel cloths, Diana. I'm going to give her a dose of Ipecac first of all. Minnie May did not take kindly to the Ipecac, but Anne had not brought up 3 pairs of twins for nothing. Down that Ipecac went, not only once, but many times during that long, anxious night when the two little girls worked patiently over the suffering Minnie May, and young Mary Joe, honestly anxious to do all she could, kept up a roaring fire and heated more water than would have been needed for a hospital of croupy babies.
I like the word croupy.
Croupy. It's like a groupie, but for a virus. No,
You
sorry.
got a lot of croupies in the house tonight.
Oh God, stop, stop! It was 3 o'clock when Matthew came with a doctor, for he had been obliged to go all the way to Spencervale for one. But the pressing need for assistance was past. Minnie May was much better and was sleeping soundly. I was awfully near giving up in despair, explained Anne. She got worse and worse until she was sicker than ever the Hammond twins were, even the last pair. I actually thought she was going to choke to death. I gave her every drop of Ipecac in that bottle, and when the last dose went down, I said to myself, not to Diana or young Mary Joe, because I didn't want to worry them any more than they were worried, but I had to say it to myself just to relieve my feelings. This is the last lingering hope, and I fear 'tis a vain one. But in about 3 minutes she coughed up the phlegm and began to get better right away. You must just imagine my relief, doctor, because I can't express it in words. You know, there are some things that cannot be expressed in words. Yes, I know, nodded the doctor. He looked at Anne as if he were thinking some things about her that couldn't be expressed in words. Later on, however, he expressed them to Mr. and Mrs. Barry. That little red-headed girl they have over at the Cuthberts is as smart as they make them. I tell you, she saved that baby's life, for it would have been too late by the time I got there. She seems to have a skill and a presence of mind perfectly wonderful in a child of her age. I never saw anything like the eyes of her when she was explaining the case to me. Anne had gone home in the wonderful white frosted winter morning, heavy-eyed from loss of sleep, but still talking unweariedly to Matthew as they crossed the long white field and walked under the glittering fairy arch of the Lover's Lane maples. Oh, Matthew, isn't it a wonderful morning? The world looks like something God had just imagined for his own pleasure, doesn't it? Those trees look as if I could blow them away with a breath. Poof! I'm so glad I live in a world when there are white frosts, don't you? And I'm so glad that Mrs. Hammond had three pairs of twins after all. If she hadn't, I mightn't have known what to do for Minnie May. I'm real sorry I was ever cross with Mrs. Hammond for having twins. But, oh, Matthew, I'm so sleepy. I can't go to school. I just know I couldn't keep my eyes open, and I'd be so stupid. But I'd hate to stay home, for some of the others might get ahead of the class, and it's so hard to get up again. Although, of course, the harder it is, the more satisfaction you have when you do get up, haven't you? Well now, I guess you'll manage all right, said Matthew, looking at Anne's white little face and the dark shadows under her eyes. You just go right to bed and have a good sleep. I'll do all the chores. Anne accordingly went to bed and slept so long and soundly that it was well on in the white and rosy winter afternoon when she awoke and descended to the kitchen, where Marilla, who had arrived home in the meantime, was sitting knitting. Let's say that one 10 times, sorry. Sitting knitting. Oh, did you see the premier? Exclaimed Anne at once. What did he look like, Marilla? Well, he never got to be a premier on account of his looks, said Marilla. Such a nose as that man had. But he can speak. I was proud of being a conservative. Rachel Lynde, of course, being a liberal, had no use for him. Your dinner's in the oven, Anne, and you can get yourself some blue plum preserve out of the pantry. I guess you're hungry. Matthew has been telling me about last night. I must say it was fortunate you knew what to do. I wouldn't have had any idea myself, for I never saw a case of croup. There now, never mind talking till you've had your dinner. I can tell by the look of you that you're just full up with speeches, but they'll keep.
When isn't she full up with speeches?
Yeah. I'm just gonna... Oh, she's just... But I like the fact she's kind of giving her structure and discipline and form, which... Mm-hmm. She had discipline, but it wasn't discipline. It was...
Well, it wasn't from a good place.
No, and it was not structure. It was just... it was oppression. She was,
Well, you know, silence. Like there's discipline, which is a form of control. Do what I tell you because I have the power here. And then there's discipline, whereas I'm trying to turn you into the best person you can be.
But I'd even say not turn. I want to ensure that you fulfill your potential and are given the structures that will keep you, you know, not get you into too much social challenges. But yes, Marilla had something to tell Anne, but she did not tell it just then, for she knew if she did, Anne's consequent excitement would lift her clear out of the region to such material matters as appetite or dinner.
Yeah.
Not until Anne had finished her saucer of blue plums did Marilla say, Mrs. Barry was here this afternoon, Anne. She wanted to see you, but I wouldn't wake you up. She says you saved Minnie May's life, and she is very sorry she acted as she did in that affair of the currant wine. She says she knows now that you didn't mean to set Diana drunk, and she hopes you'll forgive her and be good friends with Diana again. You are to go over this evening if you like, for Diana can't stir outside the door on account of a bad cold she caught last night. Now, Anne Shirley, for pity's sake, don't fly up into the air. The warning seemed not unnecessary, so she uplifted and aerial was Anne's expression and attitude as she sprang to her feet, her face irradiated with the flame of her spirit. Oh, Marilla, can I go now without washing my dishes? I'll wash them when I come back, but I cannot tie myself down to anything as unromantic as dishwashing at this thrilling moment. Yes, run along, said Marilla indulgently. Anne Shirley, are you crazy? Come back this instant and put something on you. I might as well call to the wind. She's gone without a cap or a wrap. Look at her tearing through the orchard with her hair streaming. It'll be a mercy if she doesn't catch her death of cold. Anne came dancing home in the purple winter twilight, across the snowy places. Afar in the southwest was the great shimmering pearl-like sparkle of an evening star in the sky. That was pale golden and ethereal rose over gleaming white spaces and dark glens of spruce. The tinkles of sleigh bells among the snowy hills came like elfin charms through the frosty air, but their music was not sweeter than the song in Anne's heart and on her lips. "You see before you a perfectly happy person, Marilla," she announced. "I'm perfectly happy, yes, in spite of my red hair. Just at present, I have a soul above red hair. Mrs. Barry kissed me and cried, and she said she was so sorry and that she couldn't ever repay me. I felt fearfully embarrassed, Marilla, but I just said as politely as I could, 'I have no hard feelings for you, Mrs. Barry. I assure you once and for all that I did not mean to intoxicate Diana, and henceforth I shall cover the past with the mantle of oblivion.'" That was a pretty dignified way of speaking, wasn't it, Marilla? "I felt that I was heaping coals of fire I felt that I was heaping coals of fire in Mrs. Barry's head, and Diana and I had a lovely afternoon. Diana showed me a new fancy crochet stitch her aunt over at Carmody taught her. Not a soul in Avonlea knows it but us, and we pledged a solemn vow never to reveal it to anyone else. Diana gave me a beautiful card with a wreath of roses on it and a verse of poetry. 'If you love me as I love you, nothing but death can part us two.' And that is true, Marilla. We're going to ask Mr. Phillips to let us sit together in school again, and Gertie Pye can go with Minnie Andrews. We had an elegant tea. Mrs. Barry had the very best china set out, Marilla, just as if I were real company. I can't tell you what a thrill it gave me. Nobody ever used their best china on my account before. And we had fruit cake and pound cake and doughnuts and two kinds of preserves, Marilla. And Mrs. Barry asked me if I took tea and said, 'Pa, why don't you pass the biscuits to Anne?' It must be lovely to be a grown-up, Marilla, when just being treated as if you were is so nice." It's interesting. It's just respect.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. "I don't know about that," said Marilla with a brief sigh. Oh, wow. "Well, anyway, when I am grown up," said Anne decidedly, "I'm always going to talk to little girls as if they were two, and I'll never laugh when they use big words. I know from sorrowful experience how that hurts one's feelings. After tea, Diana and I made taffy. The taffy wasn't very good, I suppose, because neither Diana nor I had ever made any before. Diana left me to stir it while she buttered the plates, and I forgot and let it burn. And then when we set it out on the platform to cool, the cat walked over one plate and that had to be thrown away. But the making of it was splendid fun. Then when I came home, Mrs. Barry asked me to come over as often as I could, and Diana stood at the window and threw kisses to me all the way down to Lover's Lane. I assure you, Marilla, that I feel like praying tonight. And I'm going to think out a special brand new prayer in honor of the occasion."
And all she had to do to gain Mrs. Barry's approval was save her 3-year-old daughter.
I know, there's a whole aspect to that. I think the fact that the doctor pointed out that she is extraordinary, like she's A, saved your daughter's life, but also she's actually extraordinary.
Yeah.
That kind of calmness, that presence of mind to going for it. And even when she was worried, she kept going.
She kept it away from Diana and the French girl. I forgot her name.
Yeah, Mary Jo?
I think so.
The idea that they shouldn't be distressed because they were already worried enough.
Mm.
Yeah, it's just incredible. And
I, you know, if you are sick or something's wrong with you and the people around you are looking worried, that doesn't help you.
No. We just read it in the, our government requirements for how to treat croup. Part of it is keep the child calm.
Mm.
Keep them away from distress.
Yeah.
Huh. Yes.
I mean, I always supposed that they'd make up somehow, you know, something would happen that would allow Diana and Anne to become friends again. But I never would have guessed that saving Diana's younger sister from dying would have been it.
No, but again, 1905.
Well, even, you know, it reminded me of when Mrs. Lynde was being very indignant to Marilla, how she goes, you know, "I've raised, 8 children and buried 2. Because I imagine, again, that idea where you have so many children because not all of them are going to make it to adulthood.
And then, yeah. So there's death is kind of a thing. if that makes sense.
It was more real.
Yeah. This really emphasized the fact that the vulnerability, especially 1905, but the vulnerability that children can experience. And I mean, it's still a thing now, though significantly more access to immediate medical care in most places. But with Anne, like, you had this situation of this is their reality. They were an isolated thing. The fact that Matthew had to go not to one town or two towns over, had to go, you know, a fair trek to get some sort of help. And
I like also that Anne knew exactly what he was doing. She's like, yep, I'm going to help her. You go find a doctor. Boom.
Yeah. It's just those. It emphasizes also how, because remember, Anne, she lived initially with one of them, with the Hammonds. They lived out back. They were with a sawmill, right?
Yeah.
Sawmills in the forest, not near the town.
Yeah.
And I like how it actually made her appreciate the time with Mrs. Hammond.
Mm. Oh, yeah, that was a great pit as well. That idea that, you know, everything you go through, the good and the bad, prepares you for where you are now.
Yeah, so she's like, I'm glad that prepared me to be able to do something. Not that you... So you don't necessarily have to actively seek circumstances that force you to learn. But if you're in those circumstances, the ability to transfer and apply that knowledge in a different situation...
Yeah.
You know, you've been through the trial by fire, so to speak. I mean, there's the ups and the downs. I liked her attitude. It's not something that you can ever again project on another person to tell how to think about their own situation. But
I don't think you should ever do that in any case.
No,
you
should never project it on another person. But for her to come to that determination, that's good for her. Like, not good for her, but, you know, it's like that's her perception and her growth and her development, which is nice.
I think it's lovely.
Yeah, it was really lovely. Yeah, it's so beautiful. But I think I'm looking forward to the next chapters. Now the friendship has been... I love how she constantly goes, Gil, I mean other people.
Yes, that's happened multiple times now, and I giggle every time I see it.
It's just funny. She's like, oh no, I should not acknowledge he exists.
And I have a feeling that's not going to be able to be kept up with for long.
Their rivalry is a bit of a weird situation. Yeah, definitely. We need some... That's almost like an ongoing tension. An ongoing challenge that Anne is experiencing. And as the authoress wrote, unfortunately, she holds a grudge. She's got a bit of a grudge issue.
Which is funny because, you know, I was praising her for that idea of the temper flares and then it cools. But that is different to a grudge.
Yeah. But she remembered the situation was, had it been only one injustice where Gilbert was implicated, it wouldn't have been a problem.
Yeah, yeah.
But there was two. So it just kind of, as she put it to Diana, I'm just remembering, the steel has entered my soul, Diana. Oh,
God. And you know, I do feel for Gilbert as well, because that second time, as we discussed in the episode when it happened, he admitted fault. He's like, no, teacher, I'm to blame. And the teacher's like, ah, you be quiet. It's obviously her fault.
Both times, he actually, the first time he's like in shock and realizing that he's gone too far. And the second time, he just outright got brushed off. I think he's realized that justice, the wheels of justice turn differently for people who are quote unquote outsiders or girls, but outsiders.
Well, he's also him and Anne are competing for a spot, but he is one of the top students in the school.
Well, he's great, but he was also behind. But yeah, both of them are top students now, so it's tough. But yes, on that note, yeah. We'll find out what the title of the next chapter is.
Yeah, that's always fun.
Wow. Chapter 19. So look forward to this guy next time. A concert, a catastrophe, and a confession.
Oh, dear. Also, I've noticed looking at the Kindle percentage, we're almost halfway through the book.
Yes. So looking forward to the continuation next week. You can catch Dave and myself on Twitter.
I'm at Dave_the_turnip.
And I'm ROOMCMOO.
You can find both our Facebook page and our podcast Twitter at smbsltpodcast. And if you would like to email us, it's smbsltpodcast@gmail.com.
The music at the top of the podcast is
Avonlea by Haygood Hardy.
And at the bottom of the podcast, it's I Am the Slime by Frank Zappa.
So until next episode, please give us some feedback if you enjoy listening to us and our discussions. We'd love to hear from you. We'd love to, actually, if you have any ideas about what books you might like us to cover in the future, we've got probably the next five or so kind of roughly mapped out, but we're always open to suggestions.
Yep, and if you've got any interesting articles or research links that are related to the book or any of the topics we raise, correct us even if we've said something that's not actually accurate. Go for it. We do not assume that we are right, ever. Because this is kind of on the fly and reacting, and we're not sitting down and doing actual research as we're doing it.
No, we're just...
Although we did look up crew.
as I've joked about before, this is a literature reaction podcast.
Yeah, without literature training. So, I totally accept
now, that now, people are now, more... Now, I have literature training. I've read lots of literature.
Yeah, although... Yep, it's okay. It is what it is, and we are quite happy for you to provide links and articles and anything that you may have read or even created yourself. We're just interested. We like this. It's interesting.
If it hasn't been made clear by the podcast, we enjoy reading, and most people I've met who enjoy reading enjoy learning.
Yes.
So, with that said, I hope you are enjoying your reading, and until next time, enjoy it further.
Yep. See you next time.